Hi, I'm Barry Stiles, founder of True Grit Pavers, and this is my startup story.
Every wildfire began with a spark. Every superhero has an origin story. And every single startup has a moment that they point to as their beginning. And every founder has a purpose that drove them in the midst of all obstacles. That is the startup story. The startup story would not be possible if it wasn't for the support of our sponsor, MoboCash. Move money like a miracle with MoboCash, the free money app that kicks cash. Download MoboCash app on iTunes or Google Play today, and you'll get your slick new Mobo card in the mail. You are no longer dependent upon digital currency alone, but you'll have a card that allows you to purchase at POS stations, restaurants, buy online, anywhere that you want to use your money. No credit check, no credit impact, quick direct deposit, FDIC insured, and free to register and activate. Support our sponsor, MoboCash. Visit mobo.cash or thestartupstory.co/mobocash. If we ever get a chance to meet in person, you will realize how much I love people. I'm an absolute extrovert. I love being around people. I love hearing people's stories. That's part of why I created the Startup Story. That is why I also love sharing reviews that you have posted about the podcast. Each week, we continue to grow, and it's only because of you and listeners like Bob Schaefer, who left a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. Bob wrote, James brings out both valuable insight and entertaining stories from some of the startup space's biggest players. This podcast is a must listen to for anyone in business, from startups, employees, and even Fortune 500 C-suites. There is huge value for anyone who wants to keep sharpening their skill set. Wow, thank you, Bob. Thank you for taking the time to write this review, and thank you for listening and subscribing. Our featured founders have amazing stories, and we know they are stories that can encourage and inspire hundreds of thousands of people. We just need to get the word out. So thank you for being a fan, and I hope you'll share the Startup Story with your friends and your LinkedIn network. Please do not hesitate to reach out to me on LinkedIn or Instagram at thestartupstory.co if I can help you in any way. Entrepreneurs support other entrepreneurs. If you have found value in any of the Startup Story episodes, please leave a review. I'll continue to read one each week, so plug your brand in the review as well. Giving your business a plug is the least I can do for taking the time out of your day to write a review. Now, let's jump into this week's episode. I find it so interesting that when people think of a startup, they immediately think of technology. In fact, I've had some entrepreneurs approach me about being featured on the Startup Story, but qualify it with, "But we're not a true startup." Every single business you interact with today was a startup at some point in time. That is why I love exploring the startup stories of a diverse collective of founders. This week's featured founder is Barry Stiles, founder and CEO of True Grid Pavers. Yes, a paving company. Like every other episode, it's not about building a construction-grade plastics company. It's about the challenges they had to overcome to get there. My hope in exploring stories like Barry's is that you will process his challenges and triumphs to see the commonality with your own journey. Because believe me, there are similarities there. In this episode, you will hear how critical personal commitment to your ideas and vision can be. You will learn some hard lessons about how to capitalize your business so you never find yourself in a minority shareholder position. You will hear firsthand how important a support system can be when life throws you some of the most heart-wrenching challenges. Business life and personal life are the same thing, because many times business is personal. When I think of Barry's journey, it is apparent to me that the first 35 to 40 years of his life were simply preparing him for the really hard challenges that he was going to face. Sure, he had 2 failed startups and found himself with $2 million in debt in his mid-30s, but those weren't even the hardest years of his life. Oh no. But let's not jump ahead. Like all stories, we have to start at the very beginning.
I was raised by lower middle class, blue collar. My dad worked blue collar work at airport. He worked for several airlines and baggage handling and customer service. And my mom was a stay-at-home mom until we got into school. And then she went and became an admin for a couple of different companies. So I was taught the work ethic. They are actually older and they were children of the Great Depression, you know, at the tail end of that. So security was first and foremost in their mind, which is not simpatico necessarily with entrepreneurship. So that was the early lesson. Hard work and security, I think, was first of all, although my mom always had a little 100% belief in us and as kids, and really empowered us to do whatever we chose to do.
So at what point did, you know, in your upbringing, again, parents being children of the Great Depression, and obviously that had a significant influence on how they raised you, and obviously their jobs are about safety and stability. When did you, was it in high school? When did you start realizing you had an entrepreneurial itch, if you will, that needed to be scratched? Or better yet, did you know in high school that you wanted to be an entrepreneur?
I don't think I knew. I knew I had, I worked hard in school. I, you know, got the good grades, did everything right, but I knew I had a little bit of a rebel in me and was just waiting to get out. I wasn't quite sure what kind of form it was going to take. So it was really later when I got into the work world that I got a little taste of corporate and decided that long-term it wasn't for me. So I really didn't, you know, I worked a lot of jobs during high school and college, everything from, you know, even before I was old enough to punch a clock, I was painting all summer. One guy painted every surface this man had. I think his fences, his homes. So, you know, I hate to paint to this day, but you know, I was always doing some type of job to make money and working hard, and I had a work ethic. But I didn't really get the entrepreneurial thing early on. Quite honestly, it was just something I did. I just, you know, had a good work ethic, I guess you could say.
So, out of high school, what was your next step?
So when I got out of high school, I, you know, obviously went to college, and I was kind of searching what I was trying to figure out what I wanted to do. And I went to UMass up in Amherst for my freshman year. I applied to some different schools, but we really couldn't afford. I was thinking of Notre Dame at the time, got in, but didn't want to burden my family with a financial stress, and decided to stay close at home. I grew up in Massachusetts. And so I went there for a year and then transferred to University of Mass at Lowell. What they had there was I was thinking an engineer. I really didn't have a clue as to what engineers did at that time. I really didn't have a good understanding, but I happened to be at Lowell, and they had a plastics engineering program that I had a friend in, and it was very unique. And I went to the lab one day, and they had these molding machines punching out ice scrapers, of all things. And of course, we're in Massachusetts.
Yeah.
and as a kid, I liked, you know, toys. I was really into sports and toys, and we used to have this old toy. I think, I'm sure it would be outlawed the way it was made now, then, but it was creepy crawlers. You could put this goop into these hot molds and heat these plates and make these giant bugs. So that's kind of what it reminded me of. It's just like, wow, this is tangible. You can make things with it. I can touch and feel it. It's not an equation on a board. It's not a chemical formula. It's not an electrical equation. It's something I can touch and feel. And it made it a lot more realistic to me. That's kind of was my introduction to what my career was going to be in plastics. So,
and how did you, coming out of that program at UMass, what decade are we talking, and what was your step out of college?
I graduated in 81, to date myself. 81, end of 81. So, and I take that back. Excuse me, I back up. I graduated in 80 and interviewed for several jobs. Fisher Price, I got an offer from, but I visited Buffalo, and it had more snow than Boston. So I said, nah, I can't go there. So, and I had an offer in Florida from Burroughs Corporation, a computer company. At the time, there was a number two computer company behind IBM. And so I thought, well, that sounds good. And I took the offer, and I was supposed to be in near Fort Lauderdale, Florida. But by the time I got out of school, they transferred me to Jacksonville, Florida. Not quite the nice beaches of Fort Lauderdale, but it was still you know, Florida. So yep. I went there and I learned a lot, and they kind of threw me in and then transferred me to the factory near Fort Lauderdale in Hollywood, Florida, 6 months in, because they had an engineer quit. Kind of just threw me right into the deep end there. And as a young guy, I had worked in college. I worked night jobs, everything I could do about plastics. I worked third shift in factories, and just to get that exposure, to get that knowledge. Like, I've always been pretty good at preparing. So I did everything I could, every kind of plastics job I could get, and part-time while going to school. So I went into the factory and just was under fire and learned on the fly. So it was really a great experience, because there wasn't a backup. It was Jacksonville had an RD program, but in the Florida factory and down there, Fort Lauderdale, they kind of threw me in and said, figure it out. And that's what I had to do, figure it out. So
what, See, this is interesting because, you know, obviously you're, so far your journey mirrors what I would assume your parents would want for you, right? Stability.
Absolutely.
Large corporations. How many more years working for big corporations did you have in this journey?
Well, I was only there a year and a half, and then my boss came out to Houston, where I'm still living, and they said, hey, we need a project manager. This is company Igloo Corporation. They were at the time the leading maker of ice chests and coolers. And mm-hmm. I thought, wow, it's cool. It's a sporting goods related product. And they did everything you can imagine in terms of plastics processing. So at that time, I was still thinking that, just getting my resume built and packed up my U-Haul and drove the I-10 to Florida with everything I had. And one December, I arrived at Igloo, and I knew it was going to be an interesting journey because I came there. The first day I pulled into the parking lot, back then they had these big computer rooms and it was glass walls. And so as I pulled in about 7:30 that morning, it was a car sticking out of the building. One of the workers in the back lost her brakes and went into the main
oh
computer.
Oh my goodness.
Car sticking out of the building, which is a very interesting way to start a company, start a job, I should say. But so anyway, she was okay.
Hey, it wasn't your job. It wasn't your car, though. So that's
it wasn't my car.
It could have been a worse first day.
Yeah, you know, and legend goes, she got out of the car and went and punched in and made sure she was on the clock. But it was an interesting journey with Igloo. I worked there for 6 years until I was 27 years old. I kind of went up the ranks very quickly and got exposure to everything there. They had 1 million square feet under manufacturing.
Wow.
I ended up going from a project manager to running their 35 person engineering division and all new products. And by the time I was 24, 25, I had written a strategic plan for the operations. Really got exposure to the whole corporate thing. What really intrigued me there was, you know, I'd have these vendors come in and guys who had, you know, owned their own business. They were maybe machine, one guy in particular kind of owned the region in terms of equipment. He had reps and he just carried himself with a nice air of him.
Yeah,
and I kind of liked that. I thought, I really have always not liked people telling me what to do. So I that kind of took note of that. And that started my thoughts about breaking out from the corporate world. And I was not real happy with the culture either. I think there was a lot of politics going on. And sometimes companies can get toxic with that stuff. And
yeah.
I'd done everything I thought I could do there and started wanting to look for my next step.
And what was that next step?
Well, I had talked to, actually, it was a purchasing manager at the time. It was about 10 or 12 years older than me, Terry Andaman. And Terry also wanted to move on. And we had talked about moving, starting I was going to be a tech guy and he was a sales guy. And we started an engineering consulting firm and sourcing. So that time people were moving to China. So we thought, well, Mexico's right here and Texas right here, and it's low cost in both places. We can start a company to do plastics to begin with in those locations. And I had a tragic event about a year before we were planning to launch and about to leave the company about 6 months. And tragically, Terry was killed in a car accident down in Mexico.
Oh, wow.
on Igloo business. So it was just horrid, as you can imagine. And
yeah.
Took my breath away, and I had to go back and reassemble myself and talk to his wife. And he said, "No, Terry, we want you to go forward." So I did. I ended up about 9 months later, I got a Christmas bonus for Igloo for, I think it was just under $6,000. And I thought I was flush. And I said, "Okay, here we go." And I had a really great partner in Mexico at a plant who had a family-owned business. And I knew some folks around Texas, too, that needed business. So I thought, here I go. So I went from supporting 1 million square feet in manufacturing and a 35-man engineering department and et cetera to rented 8x10 office with a phone and a fax and started my journey.
That is awesome. So let's break that down real quick. So how old were you at that time?
27.
27. And yep. What, this was like 86, 88?
Yeah, 80s. Yeah, I think it was 87, actually, 87.
87, okay, yep. So 87. Yep. You had 8 years in corporate America, the stability, the safe job that obviously your parents had probably dreamt of for you their entire life, again, being children of the Great Depression. Because I think the reason I'm going through all this is because our upbringing has such an influence on our journey. And You know, do you remember when you were contemplating leaving this safe, secure job, what, having that conversation with your parents?
I do, and I don't think they really understood completely, because I was doing really well in the corporate world. And again, I go back to my mom, who underlying, sometimes she was the quiet one in the background, but she was very supportive of whatever we wanted to do. And I had done pretty well in school and what I had done so far. So she had confidence that I would go forward and find my path. So she was, she's a strong woman, and she supported me very much. So yeah. Now, quite honestly, they were miles and miles away, even though we're still very close. They were up in New England. I was here in this new wild west of Houston and trying to find what my next step was. So,
what were those early days like for you? Because, I mean, you didn't have, you know, based on what you've shared, you didn't have entrepreneurial mentors. You didn't have a steps to walk in to know what it meant to run your own company, to start your own consumer acquisition. You know, you didn't have that guidance. So what were those early days like for you?
You know, I had a lot of confidence in my technical ability, but I really didn't, know what I was getting into. I'd never really sold anything. I'd never been a salesman of sorts. And it was eye-opening. It was, I really literally ate baked potatoes for like 6 months.
Oh my goodness.
I had that $6,000 in the bank, and I went out and spent, I think, $2,200 on a brochure. And from there, it was pick up the phone. And back then it was, you know, reader service cards and a few magazines. I think I advertised in appliance magazines trying to get leads. And it was really scary. And it was just, it came down to the point where I just had to make it work. I mean, I've always felt that failure isn't an option. I've got to keep going forward. And so I got down to the, I lost some weight and some pretty good shape. But there's something about necessity making your hunger, making you better. So I plowed through and got, I remember getting my first little order. Ironically, it was for a little extruded piece for a toy company, the game Uno. Company up in Indiana was looking at, and they needed a little piece to put the little game pieces on. So that little order just kind of broke the ice for me, and so I continued to push from there.
So what was the growth of that company from 87 till whenever?
You know, 87 to 89, and it was... I was making a good living. I let the rebel come out a little bit. I grew my hair, the 80s style of long hair, and just went for it. I was calling on General Electric and Fetters and big companies like that, but they would kind of look at me sideways and say, okay, you get my attention, let's see what we can do. And they needed help. And I had found the need. They were looking to try to, you know, outsource things. And they needed somebody who had the technical background and, quite honestly, the dogged nature to follow up. So I did. And I was making a good living, but it wasn't really satisfying. One of the things I found that the cultural differences, if I say, James, you're going to get your parts, we'll be there on Tuesday morning, and Tuesday morning comes and they're not there. Nothing I did, but my suppliers, as I built the supply chain, I just couldn't do that and look you in the eye. So eventually I knew I had to move on from that, because it was out of my control, and integrity has been everything to me. And I need to be, if I tell you something, it's going to happen one way or another. I'm going to call you up and say, hey, sorry you missed that, but it's coming soon. And I just, as much as I worked hard at making that happen, it just wasn't happening. So I was kind of keep my eye open, even though I was making decent money. And I thought, you know, something else would come along. And that's when Brick Toy Company came into my life.
So you shut down the consulting firm that you had?
Yeah, I basically did. I let it kind of find its own end. I just serviced the customers, but let it peter out, if you will.
What was that process like for you?
You know, it was okay, because I was so excited about my new opportunity and new thing. I was all right with it. I was transitioning. I had figured out that this was not something sustainable for me. That even though it was pre-NAFTA, it was a huge opportunity. It was I was a little bit ahead of the curve there on that, but it just, the infrastructure wasn't ready to make that happen in a good way.
Okay.
And I could have slugged it out for long term and done that, but you know, it just didn't excite me. So I've always had to have some passion in what I do, and something else came along that I found some passion in. So I was excited.
And so that next step, that passion, was, you said, in the Bricks company, correct?
Yes. Yeah, it was Brick Toy, and we found a patent. Two ex-igloo guys found a patent over in Holland that we ended up getting together. And again, I was a technical new product guy, and they brought me in, and we started Brick Toy Company. And Brick Toy was a just life-size Legos. Basically, it looks like a giant Lego, and you could build primary colors. You could build life-size, you know, castles and dinosaurs and all kinds of fun stuff. So it was a very exciting time, and you know, again, something I could have a lot of fun and passion about.
In that journey, so now Brick Toy Company, I'm going to guess you're probably early 30s?
Yeah, I was probably late 20s, just about 30 years old, yeah.
Late 20s, late 20s, early 30s.
I think we started it in 89, I think, is when the company was conceived. And so I was about 30 years old.
Okay, so now we're in the decade of the 90s, and for those of us old enough to remember the economy in the 90s, early 90s, there was a dip in the economy. What did that do for you and Brick Company, Brick Toy Company?
The dip in the economy didn't really hit me until my next business. So we were okay. We raised some early capital from friends, family, not myself, but the other guys, and basically raised enough capital to get started. And we had an exciting thing. We did good. We took it from an idea to, you know, started out with FAO Schwartz and specialty mom and pop retailers at the time, and then eventually got it into Toys R Us and Walmart and the big box guys. So it was a very, very exciting time for us. I didn't feel it was not, you know, toys are something that, you know, less now with electronics, but back then toys are something you don't ever, you know, they're whether you're in a depression or recession or toys are necessary for Christmas for kids. So, and we had a great product.
See, that's interesting. Let's talk about the toys real quick.
It was an exciting time. It was all growth and sure.
Yeah. So how has the toy industry changed from, I mean, obviously you mentioned electronics, right? I mean, everything's robotic now, but in general, for those that are listening that are, you know, contemplating toys, whether it be electronic or analog, how has the toy market changed from a go-to-market strategy, right? Because you talk about big box retailers, you know, if you were to start the Brick Toy Company now, would you try to grow it the same way you did before?
No. Obviously now with the advent of the internet and Amazon, et cetera, I would do it completely differently. Back then we went with specialty retailers and into the mass market more so, and just built it that way. That's how you got distribution. That's how you got recognition. Now it's obviously much more direct model. I've done that with True Grid differently as well, even though it's not toy business. Toys are tough now. It's a tough, tough business. It's a shrinking age, obviously, with kids with electronics, iPads and iPhones and video games. So actual physical toys has gotten a much, much smaller audience. And it's just a challenging thing. Fewer retailers to sell your products. And with Toys R Us going out here recently, last year, it's become more and more a compressed market that's difficult to navigate. Even toy manufacturers used to be open to inventors, and that's my next little story. But nowadays, it's more, let's slap a Spider-Man license on it, or Batman, and not take the risk with a new idea. So the toy industry in whole is less, I think, less innovative, and it's a much smaller market to go after. Much more difficult, I'd say, today than it was back then.
It's amazing in hearing that perspective that you bring to toy making, if you will, the toy industry, because, you know, from an outsider, you know, as you're speaking, I'm looking through, I'm like, man, that like early 90s, that was 20. I mean, I guess we're coming close to 20 to 30 years ago, but, it's amazing how within a lifetime, an industry so pivotal like toys can shrink so significantly. Like you said, age, it's a shrinking demographic. And I'm thinking of my own kids and how, you know, electronics was something that was desired by them early on in their childhood. And my kids are only 13 and 11. So it's fascinating to get that perspective that you have with the Brick Toy Company. It's incredible. You know, so you mentioned that.
No, I just said it was a great fun adventure. We did something called Brick Fest for Children, which added purpose to what we were doing. It was actually, we did a local event in Houston at the gallery, and we had 20,000 of these colored life-size bricks on the ice rink. They carpeted the ice rink right before Christmas. And we had a building contest in the junior league involved, and we donated you know, everything was for Texas Children's Hospital or the Lupus Foundation or one of these kids' charities. And we ended up using that as a marketing vehicle that across the United States, ended up doing it in 35 cities and raising $500,000 for kids' charities. And it was a lot of fun. We had, you know, it was like you invite the local media and you have basically, sometimes we had mariachis or we had music. It was a circus and the kids got out there and building contests with these blocks. And it was just a really good, heartwarming event, if you will, that we had. And that was a really special time in my life when I had that journey with that event.
What made that special? What about that made that a special journey for you?
Well, like anything, I mean, even today, when I have connection, when you have direct connection with people, so it's not just you put a box of toys on a shelf and, you know, you sell and you see the numbers come in. It's just, I had hands-on with the special needs kids, with kids doing this with parents, and you could just see the kids using the toys to develop their skills, and it was just wonderful. You know, you have kids, I have kids.
Yeah,
there's nothing like it.
Yeah.
And it's at the time I didn't have kids, so I had kids later in life. But that experience, that hands-on experience, and seeing the purpose of our toys and how the kids use them to develop their skills and themselves, it was just beautiful.
So what happened to that company then?
Well, we had there was a couple of things, and I learned a couple of lessons from this experience. So we were rolling along, we're getting distribution. Again, we weren't massive. We ended up, I think we built it about $7 million company. But we had this national brand that was pretty well known, and we had a great reputation in the business. And two things happened. First of all, we had a venture capital raise. So the friends and family, my partners, voted to basically take their friends and family out and bring some venture capital in. And at that point, I was a minority. You know, I owned about 10% of the company, I think. Mm. So that was one. And two things happened. There was one of our suppliers used the wrong plastic, and we had to have a recall, which we did. We had a phone call. Hey, my 3-year-old just came in with a piece of your brick in his mouth. So
oh, wow.
It was a horrible experience. So we did the right thing, as you suspect. We did a recall and took everything off the shelf from the retailers, brought it back, cost us $500,000, and did the right thing, which in the end is a little lesson to do the right thing, because we didn't delay. We just jumped on it and knew it was going to hurt. The retailers supported it. The public supported it. People made mistakes. It wasn't purposeful, and we made it right. And, thankfully, nobody was harmed, and we did the right thing, and it actually turned out to be a good thing for us. The other thing that happened, though, there was a plant explosion, so we used polyethylene plastic, and there was a shortage in the market, so the price of that material, which was probably 70% of the cost of our product or 60% of it, doubled within 3 months. So that combined, wow. That particularly combined with the venture capital, and my lesson with venture capital is don't lay on the debt, because we are very debt-laden in the deal that was done. And I was early on, and I didn't really completely understand the financials of it, but I was young. But I just felt I knew in my gut it wasn't the right move. But I was outvoted. And sure enough, we had so much debt. When something like that happened, which was out of our control, it just, the company couldn't make it. So we ended up shutting it down in 1987, unfortunately. And that was the end of that ride. Yeah. So at that point, I owed $2 million to the bank. I was signed on a note, and I thought, okay, everything's gone. I got I'm about mid-30s and 36, 37. Okay, I'm starting over. So I got a blue suit and went on 2 job interviews and said, no, I can't do that. So I moved into a small apartment. It cost me about $400 a month, and said, I'm going to become an inventor. And that's what I did.
Were you married at this time?
No, luckily, yeah, no. I had no wife, no kids. So that, from a business standpoint, that was great. Now you're not real attractive as a potential date if you're living in a small garage apartment and you know, don't have any income at that point. You're trying to figure it out. So
it's a good thing we don't bring balance sheets to dates, right? Oh, by the way, I'm $2 million in debt.
Yeah, it's a good thing. Absolutely. Absolutely. It's a lot more romantic to sit here.
So how did you, there's parallels in your journey and mine as far as building something and losing something so quickly. And then, the recovery process, right? it sounds like your recovery process was a bit faster than mine. How did you recover? Like, what was that? You know, in 97, you shut the company down, you're $2 million in debt, you're living in a small apartment, you know, you interviewed a few jobs, you're like, I can't do this. I became an inventor. I mean, what did you have any doubt in your ability at this time because of what you just gone through? Or did you have to process through some negative narrative you might have had in your head at the time?
I had a great idea that I just had to do. I had to do. So I knew I couldn't sleep at night until I made this idea happen. And it was in the toy business. And so the only way that I could envision at that point, instead of going through and starting a whole nother company from scratch and raising capital to do it and all that stuff, was to invent and license the idea. And so I committed to doing that. I just said, okay, this is what I'm going to do. And I'm going to take the other half. I'm an engineer by training, but I'm also, you know, creative and artistic on the other side of me. So I really wanted to exercise that side. It was a relief in some ways to be able to do that. And I just threw myself into that. And so I ended up inventing. I still had some collateral, if you will, in the toy business. We were known, so I could get in to see Hasbro as an inventor. I could get in to see toy companies. I could get a meeting because they'd known our brand, they knew our story. So that was an advantage, and I was able to do that. So I invented basically over the next few years, and it wasn't easy. It didn't, well, let me tell you, it just happened. It didn't. It took me several years to get back on track. I invented 100 items. I licensed 4, and really 2 of them made it to shelf, and one of them did pretty well. So, which was the one, and at the end of the day, I needed to make happen. So, it was not an easy journey.
What were the, just that, you know, because now you've piqued my curiosity, what were the 4 items that you were able to get licensed, and what was the one that really made it happen for you?
Well, let's see if I remember the 4 items. One was, it was a novelty toy called Hair Balls. I won't go into that one,
okay. But
it's a goofy thing. I used to love those type of toys when I was a kid. And I had a whole story. I usually have a storyline that weaves through these things. So that was one. Then there was a 3D paint by numbers, Color Me Pets. It was basically, you know, stuffed animals that you could have the paint by numbers on and create it. And that made it to shelf. 4th one I'm forgetting at the moment, but the one I really had to make happen was Blockman. And when I was in the construction toy business, which with brick toy, I've always been able to see gaps. And I could see that the action toy aisle, 2 aisles over, was about 5 or 6 times the size revenue as the construction toy. Lego, of course, is brand leader.
Yeah. Yeah.
Had buckets of blocks and had farm and city and just really mellow things with little geometric nondescript guys. And I thought, you know, boys, that's great, but boys love to build and destroy, not just build and put on a shelf. And what if we did army men that work with, you know, Lego compatible blocks, and you could build a fort, you could knock it down, destroy it, and you could use foam missiles to shoot at it, and you could put little trigger things to blow it up. And what if we had good guys and bad guys and majors move it and sergeant slam and, you know, versus crawl. And so it was a whole storyline I saw in my head. And what if we went and did Spider-Man license? And what if we, you know, so you could have a sculpted action figure look like Lego compatible guy and do a whole line. So as simple as I think that concept was, it took me probably 40 meetings before I could actually sell the idea to somebody. And I knew that Lego wasn't going to do that for the time being. They were just not that flexible. They're a big company. So I went through the whole showing at meetings at Toy Fair in New York, which is a great, is the event every year they have for 7 to 10 days. All the toy companies come together. So we go to New York and I go up and make my appointments and pitch these ideas. You know, the 6 other ideas I had in my bag, but Blockman was the one I really wanted to make happen. And everybody kept, yeah, I get it, but, and it just didn't get it. So I came back to Houston and there was a local toy company called DSI Toys. I know you've heard that name before.
Because yeah, Jason McCann, episode number 1. He had a journey through DSI Toys.
Yeah, well, that's where I met Jason.
Oh, okay.
So Jason and I are longtime friends since the Blockman days. And I went in and I pitched the idea several times to Rick Knights, who was the CEO at the time, the president of the company. And Rick if, you know, first few times, and they were an item company. In toy business, you have item companies that do TV items, they do one-offs type of thing. And okay. you have branded companies like Legos, and which are more evergreen type brands. And this was an evergreen idea. It was less of a TV item idea. So it was a transition for Rick. But so I think the third time I went in, I said, I've learned that he was actually a tank commander in Vietnam. That was his background. He had an interesting, colorful life. So I said, okay, I'm doing the Army theme. So I had, you know, my artists, I worked with local kids who could draw. And I did these concept boards and did some characters and did some different concepts and did it all Army themed with tanks, of course. And he loved it. He got it. He said, hey, I got this young marketing manager. His name's Jason. And why don't you guys figure this out? So he threw me in with Jason. And we got in a room and I just pitched Jason the idea. And of course, Jason's brilliant. And he got it immediately. And helped me get the Blockman line launched at DSI.
But how many years did you pitch Blockman for before I got picked up?
I believe it was about 2 years. I mean, hard hitting it for 2 years. And you got to remember, at this time, I really don't have any income except for a little engineering consulting I'm doing. So I'm trying to be an inventor.
Yeah.
And so I finally got, I think after 2 years, I got Rick to DSI to take a bite.
Was there any point in that 2 year journey that you thought, especially coming off of the shutting down of Brick Toy Company, was there any point in those 2 years where you thought, you know what, this just isn't for me? I'm not going to be able to make this happen. You question your ability. Was there any self-doubt at all?
I knew this was a gap. I knew this was a business, and I knew I was right on point with it. I knew I could do it. I didn't know if I could sell it because I'd never been involved in sales very much. So it was out there for sure. But it was one of those things that was so powerful that at that time, as an entrepreneur, you see a gap and you just have to go for it and you have to keep going. And for me, it's always been about persistence and perseverance and purpose. And if it's not those three things, then I don't have it. But I had it with this. It was like a thing I had, a vision I had seen, and it may not seem important to the world at this time, but it was important to me at that time to create this line, to express my artistry, if you will, in the storyline, to get this product line out there. So I didn't have any doubts that I was going to keep going until I figured it out. I would suffer through it, make sure it happened. So,
one, I'm glad. Thank you for that answer. And if you know, for those listening, if you've been with the Startup Story for a while, episode 2, we had Larry Namer, the founder of E! Entertainment Television. And he pitched for 3 years to try and raise capital to get the money he needed to start his own, you know, his own network channel. And he too, I asked him the same question because it took him almost 3 years before he got that first check and he was down to his last $60. And I asked the exact same question and his response was almost an exact replica of yours in that he believed in it so much. He knew everyone who had said no up to that point was absolutely wrong, but he was so determined that what the network, what cable was missing was what E was going to, well, at the time it was called Movie Time, but what it was going to provide. And you know what you said right here, as far as Blockman was filling a gap that was missing in the toy space, and you were just determined to make it happen. And I think that is it's a common thread for entrepreneurs, is that in the face of adversity, that there is a level of determination amidst the doubt, amidst the failures we've experienced in life. But there's something that we see this and we know that the world needs it, or that this industry needs it, or whatever the case may be. We're so determined to see this come to fruition. And that carries us through those dark days when people are saying no after no after no.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, it was something I just had to do. And I knew it wouldn't ever end if I didn't do it. So, and then so I was able to get a breakthrough with DSI and I got on board with Jason. And then I, after talking to Rick, and I said, and the other part of the equation is committing to it. So I knew that I wanted to do the best I could do and make sure I had the best shot at this. And I had never been in the military. I didn't know anything about, you know, military. I'd never been around any military folks to speak of. So I ended up finding this original Navy SEAL PT program. It was a gentleman named Jack Walston, who was an ex-Team 6 SEAL. And they were giving training in Memorial Park in Houston at 5 a.m. boot camp. So I talked Jason into going. So the two of us went down and we belly crawled through dirt and we carried logs and we got yelled at and to do 100 more push-ups and this hour and a half boot camp. And it was just excruciatingly wonderful, and it was amazing. And it was really, the lesson there was mental toughness, which I just think is really the key ingredient for any entrepreneur, is just being mentally tough. No matter what comes your way, you can get through it. You just keep moving forward. And so I did this thing. I ended up, Jason moved on to other bigger and better things, but I just kept doing it because I wasn't married, and I get up early in the morning and I loved it. And I ended up doing it for 9 years, this training at 5:30 in the morning. And it just set my day. And I think it really, really helped me in everything I've done, just to realize what you can do, even though you don't think you can. You know, when they tell you to crawl across that field and get back here and then go run 3 miles and think there's no way I'm going to do it. But when you're surrounded by people who are also committed, in that team effort, it's just really amazing what you can accomplish.
I tell people all the time, you know, one of the greatest things that came out of, I was in the Marine Corps, one of the greatest things that came out of it was the ability to know that when I want to quit, I can keep going. It's just my mind wanting to save me from whatever pain or discomforts about it to happen, but that I know there's so much more that I'm capable of. And for those listening, David Goggins is someone that I look to exemplify this. His story, he was a SEAL team member as well, but his story is unbelievable. And so he's all over the social networks, but we'll include a link in the show notes for those who want to follow David Goggins. His story is quite inspirational. So what happened? So obviously Blockman is not where you're at now. It's not your present state. Blockman probably ran its course, and you were probably, I'm assuming, with DSI throughout that. So what was that transition out of DSI? What was the next step?
Well, I went to Blockman and we did really well. In the third year, we were about to put it on TV. We made this really cool commercial with animation and kids and voiceover and welcome to the world, Blockman, all that fun stuff. And then Lego decided they wanted their shelf space back, and they kind of put the squeeze on. And at that time, you needed the top five retailers, you know, Toys R Us and Walmart, etc., Kmart. And we lost two of those, I think. So that kind of killed the TV opportunity. And at that time, DSI was having issues as well. And so Jason actually went up to start, I think he talked about his iCelebrate.com a bit. And then I was trying to figure out what my next step was. I'd made some money from the Blockman thing, and I went up there briefly to help him, and ran the warehouse for him basically, and had, you know, temporary help doing calisthenics for my SEAL training and get ready for the day and say, yeah, we got to fulfill all these orders today. And I did that for about 6 months, and wasn't for me. And then Jason ended up going a different direction. So I came back to Houston and I said, what do I know? What's tangible? I just been through this dot-com bubble and felt business model was out of whack. And so I came back and then bought two molding machines and started a factory. I thought, that's something that's tangible. I believe in Made in the USA. It's always been important to me. I'll start there. And I think I can start this factory. It was called B-Side Plastics. I love music. And
there you go. You know,
it's always been a thread through my everything I do. So I started this company in Houston and thinking that I could do this. And I was undercapitalized from the beginning. It's a very capital intensive business. It was just a very, very difficult journey for me, but I did start it and made it through the other sides. But that's what happened after.
And what happened with B-Side Plastics?
Well, I started in the year 2000. I started a company. I bought two machines and on my way back from Dallas, and we had them installed and rented some space. And then I think that, and about that time, like 6 months later, China was rearing its head and everybody was going to China. So it was okay, the big monster over there for manufacturing, things were moving overseas. So I was fighting that. And then 9/11 happened, of course, tragically, the following year. So getting out of the gate was in itself was challenging. It was just very, very difficult. I had a little foundation account with Igloo. They gave me a project that they didn't want to do themselves. So I made hinges for Igloo. So it was kind of just a foundation that I could work from, enough of a cash flow that I could build the business a little bit. So I started there. So one step by step, you know, I'm a runner, and it's always running a marathon is taking the next step. You know, and getting through the next quarter mile, half mile, knowing that you want to finish 26 miles from now, but you get it step by step. So I did that, and then I bought a building. I knew in my heart of hearts, the way I wrapped it for myself was that I was helping other people realize their dreams. So not only companies like Igloo, but inventors and people, entrepreneurs who wanted to start their own products. So I had experience with that. I could help them with the tooling, help them figure it out. And that was kind of the purpose I wrapped around, which, because I always need a purpose when I'm doing it. I'm passionate. So beside plastics, that was my purpose. I wasn't 100% with that. I knew I'd find another product that I could do myself, another idea that would excite me on my own, because I, quite honestly, I like, you know, driving ideas and starting and doing the belly crawling to get them started. So that's kind of what I do. And so it took me a while to find that. In 2007, I bought a building. And then, of course, in 2008, we had the Great Recession there and crashed. And I had to get through all that and somehow survived it. And made it through and built a little company, built a little, factory that employed, you know, a bunch of people. And honestly, that was the joy in my thing, to go walk the factory and the folks who need those everyday jobs. And just we weren't the biggest company. We didn't have the best benefits. We didn't have the best pay, but, you know, but I try to be authentic and genuine with those folks. And they appreciate it. To this day, I can walk in that factory and get hugs from some of the operators, which is special.
That's awesome.
But so I got through that, and then I was looking to, so the kind of True Grid, the idea for that kind of finally came into my vision along the way.
While you're growing B-Side Plastics.
Yeah, I was growing it. I was in it. I was not happy, honestly. I was just,
why?
I was now, one of the things I took, I was 100% owner, because I decided I was not going to be in a minority position as I was with Brick Toy again. I was out of my control and I lost everything. I had to start over. So there's a balance to that, because on B-Side, I was 100%, but I didn't have enough capital. So I didn't have enough to do it right. I had enough to kind of bootstrap it, which is good for a while. But as you're growing a business, after a period of time, you need to be able to do things right. It's great. I think it's healthy for a startup that, like, you can bootstrap it for a while, but at some point you need to scale and do things better. And I just didn't feel the passion about it that I wanted to go down that road with B-Side. So I was looking for a product line that I could do during that time, and hoping to divest the business and eventually sell B-Side and follow a path that I had more passion towards.
And that leads us to True Grid.
Yes.
Share a little bit about what True Grid is for our listeners.
True Grid is an eco-friendly permeable pavement system that's an alternative to concrete and asphalt. So it's made from 100% post-consumer high-density polyethylene plastic. You can fill it with a rock, or you could grow grass through it. It allows the stormwater to drain, such as we have in Houston, flooding issues, instead of has detention underneath the surface. So it allows the water to infiltrate over 1,300 inches per hour. It goes right through the surface, and you can slow it down and not flood the surrounding businesses and community as you detain the water. And for landowners and developers and business companies, it allows you to utilize your land. So you can use your land as a parking lot, a natural aesthetic, natural surface that absorbs the water, reduce the need for a detention pond. A lot of times you can get rid of your entire detention pond so you can use 100% of your land. So it's a very land-saving driver for developers as well. So it's an alternative to concrete and asphalt. It's a permeable paving system.
What gap does True Grid fill for you personally that you didn't have with B-Side Plastics?
It gives me a true purpose. I think I have to go back to the how it started, because I didn't get it immediately. I had gone to Europe and saw a concept that was similar, permeable paver, but mostly in walkways. And Europe's a little ahead of us. They have, in terms of recycling, they have more people in a smaller area. They're more in tune with using recycled materials and drainage because of the amount of land surface is less over there, but we're catching up over here. But what I wanted to do was come back here, and I said, hey, I can do it better. I can do it. We can drive an 18-wheeler on. So I used my plastic background and really started designing a better mousetrap. And so I saw the need over here and we live in Houston, and we have flooding too frequently. And across the country, you can see it everywhere. So particularly lately with the weather patterns as they've been. So I came back, and I was still on B-Side at that point, and had this concept. Then I met my wife. We had actually been friends and gone different paths, and we got together and started dating. And she had a three-year-old son, my stepson, Hudson. When we got married, I always say, I'll shout out to Amanda. All good things in my life happen when she got involved. So
that's awesome. That's awesome.
But so we had about a year and a half later, we had our first child, my first child, Lennon, who was born. And we were just, as you can imagine, the happiest people on the planet. And 10 weeks later, we found out his older brother, Hudson, who is now four, had a rare form of cancer, Burkitt's lymphoma. He came home one weekend from his dad's, and we lifted his shirt, and he had a hard mass on his stomach. You just feel it. So we immediately went to Texas Children's here, and we live in Houston, and we're blessed that we're so close to a great medical center. And so this went on, and we were just devastated, as you can imagine. And I remember the first night the surgeon came out after doing exploratory with Hudson to find out what was going on, or he'd done the MRIs, and came out and said, basically, we can't help. And surgeons sometimes shouldn't talk. They should just surgery, because that wasn't true. The oncology team, and we were, of course, wailing and devastated, but the oncologist said, wait a minute, that's not true. We can't do surgery, but we can treat it. So fortunately, we were able to treat it. So we spent a long 9 months in the hospital, with Hudson, as he went through this extreme chemo that no child should have to go through. He's my hero.
Unbelievable. Wow. I assume Hudson is good now?
Yeah, Hudson's now 12. He's 2 inches taller than I am. And so he's a happy, healthy 12-year-old now. So, but during that time, I was just looking at what I did on the B-side, and I just didn't feel fulfilled. And I'd go out for a run around Rice University when I could escape from the hospital room once in a while, just clear my head and pray. And that's when it started to come over me that I could, because they don't know where these cancers come from. It's whether it's genetics or foods or environmental. And Hudson always was a rare kid that would eat broccoli instead of French fries. He ate very well. we used to call him a fruit bat, because he would just eat apples by the bush. So it wasn't obviously the food he was eating, and genetics is not something we can control, but I knew the environment was something I could make an impact on. And this idea for this permeable paver could play a role in that. And I could wrap my energy and my passion around this and really try to keep plastics out of the oceans and landfills, help filter the stormwater from the pollutants going through, which product does, and really make a difference. I felt that this was something in my skill set. I wasn't going to go back to school and become an oncologist, at that point. Yeah. I could really use my skill set to be as an entrepreneur and as an engineer to provide a solution that makes the world a little better place. And so that's how True Grid started. And that's where on a little run around Rice University on their track, the power in that concept came to me.
So obviously, True Grid is purpose-driven. You have a mission for what you want to see for it. When you envision the impact that True Grid pavers can have, what do you see? How do you see it from a market adoption? How do you see it in the placement? How do you see it really impacting the environment?
Well, I've been prone to say small actions equal big changes. I really think it is a tool to empower people to make a difference. And just for instance, in places that flood, it will help absorb water. So maybe that water doesn't go into your home or into business, but you can get it down below the surface and then detain it and release it slowly. It can impact, every day we read stories about how much ocean plastic there is. And so we are using millions of pounds now to keep out of the oceans and landfills from a consumable product, from that water jug that you throw in your recycling container every week. We can take that, keep it out of the oceans and landfills, and turn it into something that's going to last 60 years in a parking lot or in your driveway or if you stay wise in your yard. So please give me a tool for people to empower people to make a difference themselves beyond then just recycling. Because we need to look at the full life cycle of materials. This plastic is this wonderful, amazing material that's done a lot of good, but it's also doing a lot of damage. So it's really how we handle these things. So I see True Grid as really being a tool for people to make small actions that collectively we can make big changes and really change the way we think about paving pavings everywhere. You step out of your house and you step on your sidewalk, you walk to your car in the driveway, you drive to work. You're on paving all the time. If we can turn that into something that's helpful and friendly to the environment as opposed to a toxic material, then we can make a change.
You know, being that TrueGrid was born out of a personal story as well as personal experiences, how does your approach to growing TrueGrid vary from your various other ventures?
I really want to make it scale properly with quality in mind, but also just accelerate the reach. So I started off with a couple of investors, Russell Benson, who's a long-term friend, and Jason, who are part of my board of directors. And we had enough capital to do it right early on. And as you're figuring it out, you know, when you start a company or start a business, you're learning, particularly if it's in a new area. Oh, this plastics product, I didn't really know that we're truly in the construction business, even though we don't install it. You know, you have to learn these things and these lessons as you go along. So I think those early years of really not having too much money in the bank and bootstrapping a little bit and learning step by step are a good thing. And then as we're in our growth curve now we have millions of square feet across the United States. Now it's time to take it to a new level. So it really made me change the way I do it. It opened me up to reaching out to good people I trust for mentorship, for a little financial investment. It's something I believed in. I knew I was committed. So if I'm committed, I'm going to make it happen. I had no problem bringing in trusted folks I know, and they've added an enormous amount of vision to me and perspective. My top 3 or 4 days a year is when we get together and look up from the weeds and look down, look on the horizon and say, okay, what's the next 3 steps we need to do to take another step closer to our goal of changing the paradigm of making people think about a permeable paver, a TrueGrid, environmental solution instead of concrete and asphalt when they do a paving project. So
that's awesome. And it's a great segue into a question that I ask every guest. And it's a question that I believe in, because I believe that if we lose sight of those who helped support us and encourage us and guide us to where we are today, then inevitably it will lead to our failure. And so it's about gratitude. And so when you look back on your journey leading up to where you are today at this time, who do you point to as key contributors to your success? And you just look to it with just an incredible amount of gratitude towards them.
You know, there's a number of people along the way. It's starting with mom and dad providing a strong, stable home. Mom for giving me that little spark and belief that I could do anything. Obviously, it starts there. There's different people away. There was a guy, my first job out of college, he was from Kentucky. I was a kid out of Boston, and he was a self-made engineer, hard scrabble. And he said, "Lead, follow, get the hell out of the way." His name was Curtis Wayne Moore. And so I tried to take that advice. I always thought that was good. If I'm not leading, I can follow. If I'm not following, I need to get out of the way and make sure everything keeps moving forward. And, you know, this Jack Walson I mentioned earlier from the SEAL thing, obviously Jason and Russell both have been a big part of my growth, particularly here in the last 10 years. So there's a number of people. And I always go back to, quite honestly, everything got better when my wife came into my world, because you know, she's the artist. It's funny because I can make 10 million of something, but if I need to make one, she can make one of anything. So she's greener than I'll ever be. She's all things good for me. So having that stability in the family really helped me personally. And of course, when you have kids, there's all kinds of purpose in your life and everything new wraps around them. So those are the people in my life really who, I think that, a supporting family. I have a brother and sister who have been awesome support along the way too. But certainly Amanda, my wife, and my kids are my center.
I love that. Oh, I love it. So now I'm going to ask you a question that, you know, for those listening, you know, for a minute here, you're going to be their mentor. You know, what do you say to those listening that might, you know, have a book full of ideas and just maybe not enough courage, or there's some hesitance and some reluctance because maybe where they're at in life, maybe they're at a 9-to-5 job and they have a, you know, mortgage, they're married with kids, and or maybe they're older, maybe they're in their 50s and they have never done a venture on their own, but they know that they are capable of something beyond what they are doing right now, and they just have a passion for doing something more, but yet there's hesitance. You know, what do you say to those people that are listening to you right now?
I say go for it, because you know, an idea is just that until it's executed. You have to take the first step. You can't run a race. You can't run a marathon. You can't cross a finish line until you take that first step and the next one after it. So absolutely go for it. There is no right time. There is never a right time. There's never a wrong time. It's just time. So I always say that time, as I've been through my journey with my son and my own cancer, time is an element you can't recycle. It's here. It's now. Be in the moment. Keep it simple. You don't have to have all the answers to start off with. You don't have to have all the funding. Just take that first step. Make it happen. Keep moving forward. And little by little, you'll wake up one day and go, oh, yeah, look where we are. Oh, and we still have ways to go, but we're moving in that direction. So go for it. Take that first step.
What an incredible journey Barry shared with us. But did you catch that bomb he just dropped at the last second there? During his journey, he shared with us the challenge and trials of his son's cancer, but he never mentioned his own cancer until the very end. So to be fully transparent, I thought about just cutting those words out because it would have just been easier to ignore. But after Barry and I spoke for a bit longer, there was quite a bit to his own personal cancer that needed to be shared.
I had started True Grit and sold my plastics custom molding business and opened up in December of 2013, opened the True Grid office and our facility in January 2014, and had a trip planned with the kids to Legoland in July. Woke up one morning, you know, 6 months after starting True Grid, and had a lump on my throat. Weird, because I was in good shape and running, you know, running and working out and very thrilled about my new business. And went to the ENT and went off to Legoland, came back, and 2 days later, I got a phone call. I had stage 4 neck and throat cancer. So that was 6 months into my True Grit journey. So it was quite the hurdle, I guess you'd say. So I went through extreme chemo and radiation treatment over the next several months, and then didn't eat solid food for 9 months. And at that point, we were just a few people in the company, and this one other person I should shout out to, Nathan Wood, who's a co-founder with True Grit, a partner, who joined me when I launched the True Grit brand. Nathan kept things together while I was trying to recover and get back on my feet, and I'll be forever grateful to Nathan for that. So, life has thrown some hurdles, but, you know, it just makes it all sweeter when you get past them.
Barry's startup story marks our 10th episode. And one thing that I've noticed as a commonality among our founders is the significance of their support system. Each founder has people in their life that provide help and support. Not everyone's going to experience a cancer scare just 6 months into starting their business. But if it wasn't for Barry's partner and friend to carry the weight as he went through his treatments, we probably wouldn't be telling the True Grit story today. Leadership and courage is not about traversing this entrepreneurial journey alone. It's about charting a path that most wouldn't. Yes, it's easy to keep our head down and grind through it all on our own, but our chances of success multiply significantly when we surround ourselves by people that will be a resource for you when you need it. Because there will come a time when you just cannot carry the burden yourself anymore. Entrepreneurs support other entrepreneurs, so surround yourself by people as driven as you are. And even find someone who is farther along the journey than you are. Well, maybe the startup story can be that mentor for you. I hope Barry's story has brought you real value. Now is your turn to deliver value to Barry. Time and time again, our founders share with me that visibility is their greatest challenge. Brand awareness is so hard in this space where it's so noisy nowadays. True Grid Pavers is a product for both commercial and residential uses. So let's support Barry and his startup by visiting truegridpaver.com and share his site on your LinkedIn profile. It's a very simple thing to share because his product is like nothing you've ever seen before, and it would go a long way to support our featured founder. But now for my personal ask. The Startup Story community has been so incredible with sharing our podcast with others, but we have more stories to tell and more people to reach. We are a startup, and the most powerful way you can support the Startup Story podcast is to leave a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram at thestartupstory.co. Share the Startup Story on your social media, either with a link or a screenshot. Make sure you tag or mention us at thestartupstory.co so we can see your help and say thank you for it. And lastly, share the podcast on your LinkedIn profile. The Startup Story is for entrepreneurs, so please do not underestimate the power of sharing the Startup Story on your LinkedIn profile so other entrepreneurs can discover us. In fact, most people struggle to share good content on LinkedIn anyways, so if you want to support the Startup Story, then search for the Startup Story company page, follow us, and share our posts to help encourage other founders and spread the word about the podcast. Every single founder has a story, and the startup stories we bring to you every week can encourage and inspire another founder. It might just be what they needed to hear to keep moving forward on their dreams. I look forward to sharing these stories every Tuesday with hopes to inspire you to start your story.